Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is the future of democracy. Today's episode is the first in a special series on the President's Inbox about the future of democracy. Over the next month, I will be sitting down with experts to discuss whether and where democratic governance is faltering around the world. This special series on the state of democracy is part of the Council's Diamondstein-Spielvogel project on the future of democracy. Here with me to kick off this special series is Yasha Munk. Yasha is a senior fellow at the Council. He is also an associate professor of the practice of international affairs at Johns Hopkins University, a contributing editor at The Atlantic, and the founder of Persuasion. He is the author of The People versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It, which was named a 2018 Best Book of the Year by multiple publications, including the Financial Times. Yasha, thanks for joining me today.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
Well, Yasha, let's talk about the health of democracy around the world. It has become quite popular in recent years to talk about a democratic recession or a democratic regression or democratic decline. You obviously have written about the faltering health of democracy. So maybe you could sketch out for us, sort of looking around the world, why it is you see democracy in decline or in retreat.
Look, I think there's two big things going on, and you've already teased one of them. So the first is that for the last 15 years at this point, we have been in what Larry Diamond has called a democratic recession. So when you look at the annual reports by Freedom House, really the best organization, I think, chronicling the state of democracy in each country around the world, for every single one of the last 15 years, more countries around the world have moved away from democracy than towards democracy. And actually, we've just had the publication of a new Freedom House report for 2020, which shows that this democratic recession has now been deeper in 2020 than in any of the previous 14 years, that countries like India, the most populous democracy in the world, no longer count as fully free. They've been downgraded to partly free. And as a result, less than one in five people around the world now live in free countries.
Can I draw you out on that, though, Yasha? I imagine a lot of people listening to this conversation would say, but wait a second, the countries you're talking about continue to hold elections. People get to vote. So what do we mean when we say that there's a democratic decline? If people get to vote, that's democracy. End of story.
So there's two different things on that count. The first is what we might call pseudo-democracy, so virtual democracy. So, you know, one of the strange things about what happened in the late 20th century, the early 21st century, is that democracy has become the only game in town. Ideologically, every country pretends to be a democracy. All of the countries of the Eastern Bloc during the Cold War, of course, pretended to be democracies.
You're talking about East Germany, Hungary, Poland.
Exactly. So my mom has a house in Italy, and the local town once addressed a letter to her primary residence in Germany, Germania Repubblica Democratica, Democratic Republic of Germany. This is a mistake. It was a couple of years ago. They somehow in the old IT system had an option between the Federal Republic of Germany and the Democratic Republic, and they thought, well, I guess it's the Democratic Republic of Germany. No, that was East Germany. It wasn't a democracy, but they had elections, but didn't have any.
Right. The old joke used to be if you had to call yourself a democratic republic, you were probably neither.
Exactly. So that's one element. Now, there's another element, which is not these completely fake democracies that hold these elections for show. There are places where elections are somewhat meaningful. There's some real competition. There is an opposition party that is allowed to run. And they might have some venues where they can say their opinion and they can hold some kinds of rallies. But the playing field between the government and the opposition is really uneven. Perhaps there are, you know, fake reasons to punish opposition parties financially. Some of their main politicians get harassed and some of them might get disqualified or thrown in jail. You know, rallies by the opposition are in danger of encountering real violence from government-backed forces. The courts are skewed in such a way that you can't quite trust the count. This is what Lucan Way and Steve Levitsky have called competitive authoritarian regimes. So there's some amount of real democratic competition. It's not like in East Germany, but you don't know the day before that 99% of people are going to vote for the government. The authoritarian leaders of these countries wake up worried about the election the day of the election, but it's not a free and fair election. It is a significantly unfair election. That's what now happens in countries like Hungary or like India that have been downgraded from fully free to partly free.
So when we're thinking about the democratic decline, it's not simply, Yash, as I understand it, about whether or not people get to vote, but the conditions under which they get to vote, what is happening in terms of the rule of law, these are the rules being written in a way or revised in a way that sort of limits the franchise. And so it's actually, we talk about democratic decline, it's a much broader phenomenon than simply whether a ballot gets cast or not, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you can have a ballot being cast in the Soviet Union, you can have ballots being cast in China today in many circumstances. But when you don't have actual free choice as to who gets to run, when the opposition doesn't get to organize properly, when you can't trust that the votes are counted fairly, that vote is a lot less meaningful.
And so when we sort of look around the world, we have sort of what a clearly faux democracy. I think, for example, the Islamic Republic of Iran, where the ruling regime basically decides who gets to run. So it's in no way a free and fair election. But we also have countries that are democracies. We talk about democratic backsliding. You've named a couple. Hungary often comes to the top of the list. India is getting a lot of talk right now, given how the Modi government has, as I understand it, sort of clamped down on civil liberties and the like. But what are the countries that you look at that were sort of strong mainstream democracies that you see this democratic recession or regression?
And this is exactly the second point that I was going to make earlier, which is that you can talk about the democratic recession and there's a kind of response to it, right? We're saying, okay, look, we know historically that we've had these waves of democratization, lots of countries trying to become democratic. And unfortunately, we know that if a country doesn't have a long democratic history, if it is relatively poor, if it is not in an area of a world with lots of other democracies, it is often going to fail. And so perhaps what's happened over the last 15 years is just a sort of reverse democratic wave where it's turned out that in some of those inhospitable terrains, these first attempts at democracy aren't working. Perhaps they will 10 or 20 years from now, but that shouldn't surprise us. The fact that democracy is unfortunately struggling at the moment in Tanzania, in Kenya, in India, perhaps is not as surprising as we're making it out to be. And so we shouldn't worry too much about the democratic recession. That's the sort of response, right? The reason why I don't think that's convincing is that there's also all of those democracies in the real heartlands of democracy that are experiencing challenges that no political scientist foresaw 10 or 20 years ago and that really are testing their health to the limit. I think we had such a test in the United States over the last years, but that is also what's happening in countries like Poland and Hungary, which political scientists thought were pretty stable 10 years ago. When I was in grad school, I was told if a country has changed governments for free and fair elections at least a couple of times and has a GDP per capita of more than about $14,000 in today's terms, it's safe. You don't have to worry about whether it's going to be a democracy. Well, countries like Poland and Hungary qualify under those criteria. They should be completely safe and stable. And yet we've seen the extent to which the democracies significantly downgraded over the last years, precisely because they no longer offer truly free and fair elections. The work of the opposition is impeded in various important ways. The government has taken control over courts and the judiciary in really quite worrying ways. Freedom of speech and academic freedom is under attack in many of those countries. And that, to me, is the most worrying thing about what's happened over the last years, because it's not just that democracy is in retreat around the world. It's that even in the places where we thought we could take democratic stability for granted, we suddenly have reason to worry about it.
So can we talk a little bit about why this is happening? And I must say, I'm struck in reading polls. It came across a 34-country Pew Global Attitude Survey, Yasha, which was conducted in 2019. And it found that a majority of people in democratic countries are dissatisfied with how their democracy works. That seems to be a troubling number. So maybe you can sort of walk us through what are the explanations for why so many people in established democracies, unless we're going to talk about established democracies here, seem unhappy with democratic governance.
Yeah, this is one of the striking findings, that people in established democracies are really unhappy with their governments and they don't really trust their political institutions. You know, famously, the approval rating of Congress in the United States is a little below that of used car salesmen. But it's actually that they're increasingly skeptical of the system of government itself as well. This is work that I've done with Roberto Stefan Faure many years ago, that even when you ask people, how important is it to you to live in a democracy? How do you feel about authoritarian alternatives to democracy, like army rule, support for democracy has really declined. I think there's three primary reasons for that in North America and Western Europe and some of the other developed democracies around the world. The first is economic. From 1935 to 1960, the living standard of an average American doubled. From 1960 to 1985, it doubled again. Since then, it's been more or less stagnant. It's gone up a little bit, but really not very much. And you have similar stories in a lot of Western Europe. You know, the decades of the Wirtschaftswunder in Germany, over Trente Glorieuse in France, those decades of really rapid economic post-war growth were followed by decades of much slower growth. And that has transformed how people think about the world. They used to say, hey, you know what? I'm so much more affluent than my parents were. My kids are going to be so much better off than me. It's not that I love those politicians in Washington, D.C. It's not that I trust them completely. You know, people never did. But in the end, they seem to be sticking to their end of the deal. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt. And I think that's gone out of the window. People now say, I'm not doing much better than my parents were. I really fear that my kids are going to do worse than me. So let's try something new. How bad could things get? The second point is that we've seen very rapid cultural and demographic change in many of these societies. Virtually all developed democracies were either founded with a pretty homogeneous idea of themselves. You know, who was a German or Italian or Swede in 1960? Well, somebody whose parents or grandparents or great-grandparents had also been from there, right? It was an ethnically and in many cases religiously homogeneous idea of who belonged. And because of decades of migration, we have started to change those conceptions. And actually, majorities in those populations are now comfortable with the idea that you can have a German or a Swede or an Italian who comes from outside of a country or who has roots outside of Europe. But there is a significant minority of a population who's very angry and exercised about that. In the United States and Canada, we've always had countries of immigration. We've always had more diverse countries. But we also used to have, obviously, a very strict racial and religious hierarchy with one group at the top and everybody else at the bottom. And the one thing that you see in common across these democracies is that people who used to be socially dominant and no longer are vote for populists in greater numbers. So if you ask people to place themselves on a kind of social ladder of prestige, and you ask them, you know, if society had 10 steps, where are you? On the bottom step and the top step, somewhere in between. People who say 30 years ago I was on the 7th or 8th step, and now I'm down to the 4th or 5th step, they are likely to vote for populist politicians and parties. And the third, very quickly, is obviously the rise of the internet and of social media, which has many good things about it, but which also makes it easier for extreme politicians, new political movements to form, bypass traditional gatekeepers, and organize the worry and the anger that stem from those other structural causes that I've talked about.
So you've mentioned a word that's been used a lot over the last decade. And before 2009, 2010, I'd only really heard it when I took American history classes, and we talked about the end of the 19th century. And that term's populism. So populism is a big word right now. I'm not sure everybody means the same thing by it. So maybe you could sort of help us out. What do you mean by populism, and how does it relate to a term I've heard a lot in the last couple of years, which is tribalism? Certainly in the American context, sort of people breaking up into tribes.
I agree with you that populism is actually a helpful way of thinking through this. You know, why do we lump together politicians like Donald Trump in the United States, Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Viktor Orban in Hungary, Recep Erdogan in Turkey? On many counts, they have real differences to each other, real dissimilarities. You know, when you look at which groups they like and which groups they dislike, it's different from country to country, right? Some of them say that they want to scapegoat Muslims. Some of them want to scapegoat anybody who's not a Muslim. Some of them are ideologically right-wing. Some of them are ideologically very left-wing, like Hugo Chavez. So it'd be easy to say, hey, they don't have anything in common. I think they do. I think what they share is a kind of political narrative, a way of thinking about the political world, which is to say, the only real reason why we have political problems today is that there's an elite that is self-serving and corrupt, that's in cahoots with various outsiders who don't truly belong to the people, who don't truly belong in our country in many cases. And so all we need to improve the world is, for me, the populace, to give voice to the real voice of the people, get rid of these elites, and we're going to fix everything. And the key point of this is a sort of claim to the exclusive moral representation of the people. It's to say that I and I alone truly represent the people. The person who has put this best in 11 characters, I believe, perhaps it's 12 characters, is Evo Morales in Bolivia, whose Twitter handle reads Evo es Pueblo, Evo is the people. That is the core of populism. And what's dangerous about it is the exclusive nature. Because if I am the voice of the people, then none of the normal mechanisms of the rule of law, none of the usual checks and balances are legitimate. If I am the people, then how come the press criticize me? They are against the people. If I am the people, how come a court says this executive order is overstepping the boundaries of your constitutional authority? Why is this court plotting against the people? That is what drives many of these politicians to concentrate power in their own hands in a very worrying manner. Now, that is what I refer to when I talk about populists or authoritarian populists. It is people who share this conception of politics that drives them to attack democratic institutions in the vast majority of cases. Now, you were talking about the American context. And annoyingly, there's also a completely different set of things that we sometimes refer to by populists. And that is a certain kind of political instinct or ideology that comes out of the late 19th century, the agrarian populists who were angry at monopoly, who were angry at many of the big corporations in the late 19th century. And there's still some politicians who have a sort of line of descent from them, Elizabeth Warren perhaps being the most obvious one. Now, some of those politicians might be populists in my sense, but there's no inherent way in which those two things are linked. So, you know, when I talk about populism, I talk about politicians who have this claim that I alone represent the people. I'm not necessarily worried about somebody who dislikes monopoly or who wants to raise taxes. That might be wise, but might be unwise. That's not what I'm talking about.
Okay, so there's obviously the problem that you have in all of language, all discussions, that words don't necessarily mean the same thing to different people, or they may change over the course of time. And I take your point that, again, you think of American agrarian populists, they were trying to break what they saw as the unfair dominance of Eastern elites that controlled their lives and wasn't necessarily dedicated to hostility toward outsiders in a particular way. But what about this issue of tribalism? Because again, this is sort of merged into these discussions, and certainly in the American context, we now talk about the two political parties as sort of forming tribes. I mean, there's lots of data exploring this. One of my favorites has to do with polls asking Republicans and Democrats, how would you feel if your child married somebody who belonged to the other political party? If you go back 50 years, it was no big deal. You look at the numbers today, and sizable chunks of both parties regard the prospect with horror that their child might marry somebody who belonged to the other political party. How does that figure into this conversation?
That's a great question. I mean, I don't think that those two are logically connected, but okay, they're often empirically connected, right? So you can have political systems without populists, but are deeply tribal. You know, I think many European societies in the 1950s or 1960s were quite tribal. You know, if you were a working class person, you may have been a member of a German Social Democratic Party, as well as a labor union. And there was a whole set of associational life affiliated with that. And, you know, if your child went off to university and ended up marrying somebody who came from a upper middle class, a bourgeois family, who was active in the Christian Democratic Union, that might have really been a little difficult to deal with. I mean, those were quite tribal societies in that kind of way, but both the Social Democratic Party and the Christian Democratic Union were responsible political parties that weren't populist, but weren't dangerous to democracy. You can have tribalism without having populism necessarily. But what's certainly the case is that populists thrive on tribalism, because they thrive on saying those who don't agree with us aren't even truly Americans, they aren't even truly Germans, they're against our country. And so we don't just have a legitimate political disagreement with them, they are evil, right? And that obviously deepens political tribalism in a very worrying way. And I think relatedly to that, they then manage to inflame tribalism even further. Because of course, when you have people who in fact are dangerous to the democratic system, who say half of the population doesn't really belong, they aren't really truly members of this country, then the response to that is to say, well, the people who are saying that are themselves really dangerous too, and we should exclude them in order to make our democracy work. And so you start having this real sense of mutual existential threat. And how to break out of that is an incredibly complicated question to which I think nobody has quite figured out a good answer. And that is certainly where a country like the United States is now at. And as you're saying, those polls that show the extent to which Americans would hate for their child to marry someone who votes for the other political party are really quite concerning in that respect. There's also interesting experimental studies where you get people into a lab and you ask them to give out a sort of made up scholarship to various applicants. They think we're really awarding these scholarships to people, and you manipulate their CVs a little bit, right? So there's just a couple of differences in them. One of them is race, and unsurprisingly, depressingly, people prefer people of their own race to some extent. It's not a very big impact at all, actually. It's a small difference. But if you manipulate, you know, somebody was a president of their Democratic club or the Republican club in the high school, that makes a huge difference. Democrats really discriminate against against Republicans and Republicans really discriminate against Democrats, more than whites discriminate against blacks or blacks discriminate against whites, at least in the context of this particular study. So that shows us the depth of a political divide in the United States now, and that certainly is very worrying.
Yasha, I want to move on to the question of what we do about it. Before we did, I have one last question just about the nature of the problem, which is that I've seen a lot of reporting, a lot of polling that suggests that young people in particular are much more skeptical of democracy. And in a way that's puzzling, given that you tend to think of the young as being idealistic, you tend to think of young people not having been disappointed yet by how things can go in life. Do you make anything of the fact that it seems that younger people are more likely to be disapproving of democracy than older people?
Yeah, so this actually comes out of a study that I did with Roberto Foa, which I mentioned earlier. And we were very struck by this finding that, for example, at that time, young and affluent people in the United States were more likely to favor army rule than other demographics, which I think is really quite striking. I think this comes a little bit from different historical experiences. I think older people both have more proximity to the years in which it felt like democracy was delivering for them. There was economic growth. They have a more direct connection to what it was like 50 or 75 years ago economically. And then, of course, many of them did still grow up during the Cold War, or in some European countries are still closer to the legacy of fascism. And so they know what it means to live in a non-democratic regime. I think a lot of younger people now take a lot of what's working and a lot of what's good for granted, and they don't have the same optimism about the future, and they don't know what it means to live in a communist regime or what it means to live in a world in which there is a threat from communist regimes. They certainly are very far removed, thankfully, from the history and the legacy of fascism in most countries in the world. So I always think of a beautiful joke that David Foster Wallace told in his commencement speech at Kenyon College, which is that an old fish encounters two young fish in the sea. And the old fish says, "Good morning, boys. Good morning. How's the water?" And the young fish sort of, you know, smile embarrassedly and swim on. And when they're out of earshot, one of them says to the other, "What's that old fish going on about? What even is water?" And there's something, I think, to that many people don't understand what democracy gives them, don't understand how terrible non-democratic regimes are. On the plus side, this means that many young people become energized when authoritarian populists take over. They start to recognize the threat and they start to deepen their commitment to democracy. But of course, in many cases, it's too late, because once those kinds of people are in office, it becomes harder and harder to displace democratically elected leaders by democratic means. So the fact that young people might at that point wake up to the threat, the fact that many young people in Venezuela probably value democracy very strongly at this point, unfortunately doesn't mean that those countries will necessarily be able to get back onto the democratic path.
I should note on that score, when we talk about these polls of younger people being less optimistic or supportive of democracy, those are not polls taken in authoritarian countries. You just mentioned Venezuela. We look at Belarus, we look at Russia, we look at Hong Kong. We see young people turning out along with other citizens protesting. And of course, there's an irony here, which, you know, on the one hand, we're talking about the decline of democracy and people's dissatisfaction with democracy in both new and established democracies. If you go to autocracies, you can find lots of people who dream of the day they can have democracy and are willing to put their life on the line for it. So I don't think we want to paint a picture that sort of the promise of democracy, that candle, has been snuffed out around the world. Yasha, I mean, you spent a lot of time thinking about these issues. You've visited a lot of countries. You've talked to lots of researchers about the issue. How do you reverse the democratic recession? How do you reverse the democratic decline? I suppose you could say we could all experience what life is like in an authoritarian government and realize that's not what we want, but that's not an experiment we're going to conduct. And as you point out, once you go authoritarian, it's very hard to get back, even when people are really opposed to a government, because of the tools authoritarians can bring to bear. So what are the public policy recommendations? What is it that either government should do or people who are concerned should do, businesses and the like?
Yeah, it's a very hard question. The first is to recognize the stakes here. You mentioned businesses, and just to say something to that, because I'm sure that many influential business people listen to this podcast.
If they don't, they should, Yasha.
They absolutely should. You know, you really want your profits to depend on your ability to make a good product and find customers for it and sell it at a reasonable price, rather than on your connections to the local government. And what you see in one country after another, Turkey, I think, is a good case of this, is that once populists are really entrenched in power, your ability to turn a profit depends on bribery and political connections. And that's not good for long-term economic growth of those countries, and it's not good for the businesses that operate in them. So I think it's really something that business people should care about as business people, not because business people should do politics, but because that is actually important to the long-term health of their businesses. The question depends a lot on sort of which context. I'll say four or five slightly disconnected things. One is that those political parties that stand up to populists really have to make sure that they don't feed the tribalism and that they don't feed the pessimism. Populists win when it feels like society is deeply split and the future is going to be worse than the past. And you can stand up to that by clearly condemning the populist politicians, but not the people who voted for them. You cannot write off half of the population if you want to move beyond those populist moments in a serious way. I think the new mayor of Istanbul did this very well. He comes from a traditionally very secularist party, and many faithful Muslims always felt that it was quite hostile to them. He went to tour the mosque of Istanbul to show that he does not have disdain for the deeply religious, that he wants to reach the voters that helped Recep Erdogan to power, even though he was very critical of Recep Erdogan. He talked a lot about love and a lot about unity. And I think Joe Biden's presidential campaign was quite successful for similar reasons. So I think that's an important thing. It's something that's very hard to do because of the way that populists poison the political atmosphere. But if you start playing at their level, they win every time. Another thing more broadly, beyond politicians, goes for the intellectual and the cultural elite. I do think that, and I will say we, because I think we should all know our place. And by virtue of being a senior fellow at CFR, I think I belong in the elite in that way. We should be honest about that. I think there's a way in which many of my friends and colleagues have become disconnected to a lot of the country and have started to think that we can impose our views and our desires on the countries, that there's something wrong with most of our compatriots and we should teach them how to be decent people, and we're going to do that whether they like it or not. And that is a huge danger. I've developed something called the reverse beer test. So in the 2004 elections, there was this theory that George W. Bush won the election because people would rather have a beer with him. I think that's the wrong way of thinking about it. Most voters know they're not going to have a beer with a president, so why would they care? I do think the question that really matters is, if the president walked into my living room right now, would they enjoy having a beer with me? Would they judge me in my living room? Would they judge me on my views? Would they judge me on what's up on my walls? Or would they like me? And I think too often the people standing up against populists have failed the test and the populists have won the test. There's a question on foreign policy, of course. We are now in a situation in which Europe has some leaders who are starting to wake up to the danger to the European Union from its member states, Poland and Hungary, becoming non-democratic over time. We have a new administration in the United States that thankfully does not give an especially warm welcome to people because they're attacking democratic institutions in their country, as partially happened in the last years. But I think those countries will have to push harder and go beyond the traditional diplomatic playbook if they actually want to push back against the authoritarian resurgence. And one of the things they will have to do is to re-look carefully at the membership criteria of organizations from the European Union to NATO. Because if you continue to have members within those organizations that violate the values to which those organizations are sworn and that clearly do not pursue the purpose of those organizations, they will become dysfunctional over time. So I think the EU has to find ways to incentivize Poland and Hungary to get back onto the democratic path or to suspend the membership otherwise. And I think NATO has to have a very serious conversation about Turkey's membership in the alliance for similar reasons.
Let me just ask you a question about that, Yasha, in closing, because it ties back to where we began the conversation about people feeling disconnected from their government, feeling that the government is controlled by elites, the feeling that the problems and issues of other people are being addressed and theirs are being neglected. That's the story that populists play on. And when I have conversations with people about U.S. foreign policy, what I often hear from people is, you know, we spend too much time worrying about problems overseas. We should stick to the knitting and take care of problems here at home. We obviously have lots of them. So before we're going out and fixing democracy somewhere else, why don't we fix problems here at home? And then there's a variant of that argument, as you know, which is, how can America fix democracies abroad when its democracy here at home is broken or at least fractured? What do you say to arguments like that?
Well, there's two different pieces of this. The first is that we should be upfront and clear about our own flaws. And certainly, I I think the Biden administration is wise to acknowledge that the United States can't just come back onto the international scenes after 4 years of Donald Trump and say, you know, we have all of the answers and we're going to tell you what to do. But democratic reformers around the world, democratic activists around the world want the support of the United States and are grateful for it when it materializes. When you look at people like Alexei Navalny being poisoned and then locked up in Russia, when you look at the terrible repression against the courageous pro-democracy activists and protesters going on in Myanmar at the moment, when you look at courageous people in other parts of the world, they want the support that we can give them. And so, you know, yes, there are many flaws in the United States. Yes, especially after the last few years, we should be careful not to come off as lecturing the rest of the world. But I think it is a form of provincialism to say things are so terrible here that it would be wrong of us to stand up for the people who are jailed, who are tortured, who are killed in other parts of the world. Substantively, I continue to believe that the United States is safest and that it's most prosperous when we have decent governments around the world. And I also continue to believe that, you know, Americans can walk and chew gum at the same time, and they don't want a world in which people are needlessly suffering. And insofar as we can do something to help them lead free, self-determined lives, Americans are generous enough to want to be able to do that. That doesn't mean that we should get into military adventures around the world that are ill-conceived, as we certainly have done at various points in our history. It doesn't mean that we should do what Barack Obama used to call stupid stuff. We should be realistic about what the United States can achieve in the world. But absolutely, I think that the citizens of every country in the world would like to be able to live in a self-determined way, don't like corrupt, self-serving dictators, don't like people being thrown into jail or murdered if they challenge the powerful. And when there are opportunities for the United States to help push the world into a more democratic direction, we absolutely should seize it.
On that optimistic note about American capability and competence, I'm going to close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Yasha Munk, Senior Fellow at the Council. Yasha is the author of The People versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It, which is available in your local bookstores. I should also note that Yasha is the author of an article in the most recent issue of Foreign Affairs Magazine entitled Democracy on the Defense. Yasha, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guest, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe did double duty as a recording engineer. And as always, thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.